Hello, everybody. Today we have Jeffrey Armstrong. Welcome, Jeffrey.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be with you.
My first question to you is, why didn't you become a stand-up comedian?
You know, I was interviewed for a magazine back in the 80s, and I answered that question this way. I said it was better than becoming an axe murderer. And a week later, I saw an interview with Robin Williams. He was asked the same question, and he said it was better than getting an assault rifle.
Right.
So it turns out that comedians are first deeply injured and offended by the terrible things that are happening in the world. And they're trying to deal with their anger, and they don't want to become like the terrible things. So they finally conclude that the only way to be healed is to be able to laugh about those terrible things. So they take that extra step that most people don't take, and they turn the poison in their system that's hurting them so much into a nectar that's pleasant and makes you laugh and giggle and be happy. And so I had to go through that journey myself. As it turns out, it prepared me to later be a spiritual teacher, because if you're used to being laughed at, then you don't really care if people don't like what you're saying or like it. You care, but you don't care, because you'd like to please them, but you know some of them won't be happy no matter what you do, so you smile.
Beautiful. Thank you. What happened to turn your life around?
Well, for me, it was more of a continuous journey than a turnaround. A lot of people have the kind of story that was they became an alcoholic or they had great tragedy. I never had any of that. In fact, my greatest pain came from seeing the pain of the world. But by the time I was 13, the only thing I really wanted to be when I grew up was someone who had the answers to why we're here and who we are and what life is really all about. So that became my passion and stayed my passion my whole life.
All right. There are so many styles of yoga. But what are the original principles of yoga?
Right. And you're absolutely right that the Vedic knowledge loves biodiversity. In fact, it champions it so much that anyone who's a yogi is not willing to be coercive over the ultimate truths that they think are so important. And because of that, they're willing to allow many varieties rather than ever try to force someone to a ultimate conclusion. So that's the first part of the answer. And the second part is that the many kinds of yoga all revolve around a very simple paradigm, which is that there are two realms of existence, one a transcendental, which the Vedas describe as three-quarters of existence, and one a material, which the Vedas describe as one-quarter of existence. And there are the many atmas, or souls, ourselves, who are from the transcendental but able to visit the material. And once we do visit the material, the likelihood is we'll have times when we're covered over by the darkness of matter and entirely forget who we are. So the reawakening of our remembrance of ourself as a transcendental entity and being able to stay in that consciousness with a direct link to the transcendental while being in matter is called yoga.
All right. Some of my viewers or my listeners were asking me, what does namaste really mean?
A lot of times you'll hear people say, I bow, and then they'll say something to the God within you, to the divine within you, all partially true. But the actual Sanskrit is far more interesting. Na means not, and ma means me, and te is the personal pronoun for you. So it's actually having a moment with someone where you don't look at their clothing or their skin or their ideas or their culture. You don't see them in terms of the externals that are riding along with them. You look through the window of their eyes to their consciousness, and you see that it's coming from a divine being who's inside of all of that. And for a moment you say, not me, which is what we're all saying, me, 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 our favorite song, mm-hmm. for the most part, but you. And it means trying to extract that divine potential that's in them that even they may have forgotten about for a moment, which we all do. And you're bringing it to their attention again, but in such a way that it's very inviting, because you're not coercively saying what they are. You're saying, I see all of this divine potential in you. So for a moment, not me, look at you. Look how incredibly full of potential and amazing things you really are.
All right. Can you please explain the Vedras?
Veda.
Veda.
Mm-hmm. And what you said when you said Vedra is very useful, because words morph and change as they move from one locale to another. People pronounce that letter differently. So the word Veda became the English word video. And video is, of course, something that you watch. The word Veda in Sanskrit means to see. But it's a particular kind of seeing. It means to see with transcendental vision. And as I said a moment ago, to have a perspective on all of this that has come in or been transmitted inside of matter from outside. So Veda is defined as a library of knowledge which was either received by transmission to yogis, and then they wrote it down, or memorized it and wrote it down later, or given by visitors from the transcendental avatars coming to this world and speaking it. So the Veda is a library rather than one book, and in it is both material and transcendental knowledge, but all given from this kind of downloaded perspective, as you could be an advanced yogi and technically download more Veda. And if it stood the test of time, it would be incorporated as Veda after a while, as always true is another way to say that. And it would give you the experience that when you heard it, you would see things in a particular way. Hence, Veda means to see. It later became vid and wit. Our English word wit is directly, the W was the V of Ved, and it became V-I-T, then W-I-T-T, and witty is Vedic, viti, meaning having a lot of insight, seeing things very interestingly. So the Veda is a whole library that gives you this supposedly divine perspective on who we are and where we are and how things work.
All right. Why are you so fascinated, you as Jeffrey Armstrong, why are you so fascinated with India and the philosophy around this ancient culture?
You know, anyone who is hungry for learning runs at the knowledge from one subject angle and tries that for a while, and they see how far back they can go. It's kind of like a game. So, like, I studied literature and was an English major. So if you push back English, you'll find out that the first dictionary was made in the 15th century. The first dictionary. There was no English dictionary before that. When Shakespeare wrote, there was no English dictionary. So that's interesting. So if you then find yourself in the 15th, 14th century with a language with no dictionary, then you would automatically ask, well, who had one before then? If you ask that question, you'd end up in Greece, and you'd end up with the Romans. You'd certainly end up with the Romans first. Then you'd find that the Greeks were older than them and were their mentors. And then if you asked who was older than the Greeks, you'd cross the Mediterranean and find yourself in India, and you would find out that the Sanskrit grammar was written down, the final grammar of 4,000 grammatical rules was written down by a fellow named Panini in the 800 BC. So in 800 BC, a complete grammar with dictionaries, etymologies, and everything was written down with 4,000 grammatical rules for a perfect language, and that event happened in India. Well, that's one pathway. Now, if you go around to psychology, you hear a lot of different theories, and then you find out that all of these psychologists had read about or traveled to India. And you find out that they've incorporated their, like Maslow, a hierarchy of needs. There's different levels that you go on, and then you go to a higher need and a higher need. That's the five chakras, or the seven chakras. You start out at this one and go to the next one, go to the next one, go to the next one. And then if you go to Emerson and Thoreau, the American Transcendentalists, so-called, then you find out that they actually studied the knowledge of India that was in translation and making it over to America. And they segued from Orthodox Christianity to Protestantism to Unitarianism and then out into their own viewpoint, which was called American Transcendentalism, but it really was Vedic knowledge. But no one was comfortable at that time calling it Vedic knowledge. So they, again, the pathway led back to India. I kept doing this, and everything kept leading back to earlier than 2,500 years, to 10,000 years, 15,000 years, the archaeology, the science, the philosophy. So you've heard the saying, all roads lead to Rome. Well, in this case, I think they led to Delhi, or maybe somewhere up in the Himalayas instead. So I just kept going back and asking, why don't more people know about this ancient culture then? Why is it pushed into the background?
There's a story that my uncle in Bangalore, and as I was filming in India, which is my job at the time, was filming, he told me a story. He said that this was in the 1990s, and he was saying that our people in India are going to change and become more Western. There will be teachers who will come from outside, take our knowledge, as you said, polish it or refine it with the other knowledge. And when our people are ready, we will then be able to accept this old knowledge which has been polished. Is that what you're doing?
Absolutely. 100%. In fact, as a high-level language user of English, I could have studied many languages. Instead, I've studied Sanskrit and English, a little Spanish. Poquito.
Poquitín.
Poquito de español. But mostly these two, so that I could be most effective in one thing, refining the translations of the Sanskrit into English and bringing them in such a way that they illuminate the understanding, make the ancient knowledge available to people who are English-speaking. And now, since English, in the form of colonialism, first swept the world, co-opted all of these civilizations into its knowledge and technology, the saying I like is that India, that the British conquered the world. That the British conquered the world for 500 years with gunpowder, and India conquered the world in 50 years with curry powder.
Yeah.
So now that English is a universal language and will remain so for the next 100 years or so on our planet, for sure, then I'm betting that bringing this knowledge into English in a powerful and clear way, polishing it, as you said, will then make it more digestible to the people who are learning the technological skills that they need to adapt to the world as it is now. And the meeting point of that vector is over the next 10 years. So I'm convinced that Sanskrit is a new lexicon of words and meanings for a cooperative planet, in the same way that computers forced us to have dictionaries with hundreds and hundreds, even thousands and thousands of terms to work with our technology. So similarly, we now will have new old terminology from the Sanskrit with English meanings that allow us to work with each other as a unified planetary culture.
Okay, one of my major themes on the health show is stress. So when we talk about stress, I would like to know from you, what are the best ways of using yoga for stress?
Let me expand upon the word stress and add to it the word tension. Because one of the Sanskrit words that's been mistranslated so much in our culture, in its first entrance, is the word tantra, which does not mean sexuality at all. Tantra means tension, or rather the ten of tension in English comes from the tan of tantra in Sanskrit. So tension, of course, stress being simply the symptom of improper tension. The word tantra is used always with its companion word yoga as yoga slash tantra, because if we are transcendental beings and we don't know it, it's going to change our tension and we're going to be stressed and not know why, like a fish removed from the ocean, suffering but not knowing why because it forgets that it's supposed to be in water. So if we're supposed to have one stream of awareness that's transcendental and one that's material, but we're only material, then our tension and our stress are partially the result of that. They're also partially the result of the fact that everything within the material world is temporary, and we are intrinsically uncomfortable with that. We're not taught that we're a transcendental being visiting a temporary world. And so we keep projecting the idea that everything should last. But the fact is that everything here doesn't last. It's very stressful to expect something to happen that can't happen. So I see people all the time who come to me as clients, and they're stressed over the fact that someone just died that they knew. Their body just died. But I asked them, do you know anybody's family, parents, grandparents who didn't? Did you not expect this to happen? Did you think you were the exception? Did you think about it at all? And that's probably the answer. They probably didn't prepare because they didn't want to be in a temporary world. So they went, la, 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 everything's fine, la, 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 until they had to face it. So yogis first get a philosophical framework in which, just by having that framework and seeing the world as temporary, a lot of stresses immediately dissipate. And then they develop a tantra, a kind of push-pull relationship with the things around them, till they find just the right tension. And in that just the right tension, we're both pushing hands now. Push back more. In that just right tension, there's a place that's sustainable, and the stress is not too much, and we're expressing ourselves just right. That's called correct tantra. Mm-hmm. Now, there's not stress from that. So stress is an indicator that the tantra is wrong. And so stress is like a gauge on your car telling you the engine's overheating. It's stressed. And you're supposed to respond by changing the tension of the situation. So this is the day-to-day living of yoga slash tantra and relates in every way then to what we call health and well-being.
We're just going to take a short commercial break and I'm going to play you my music. And after that, we'll continue with Jeffrey Armstrong. If you want to, you know, find out what Jeffrey's up to, just go to jeffreyarmstrong.com. jeffreyarmstrong.com. Thank you. Hello, everybody. I'm Iqbal. Do you feel stressed? Do you feel tired? Are you having difficulty focusing, can't relax, brain chatter, need an audio sleep aid? Go to Healing TV.
www.yogaiv.ca, and your audio download solutions are all there on the online store. Just click on store. Thank you.
At the seed event, you mentioned wireless. And what I'd like to know about the wireless system that you were talking about, what does wireless spirituality mean to you?
I'm going to do a language refinement for you. Since spiritus means to breathe. When someone says to me, I'm spiritual, I say, I'm glad you're breathing. It isn't that they're being insincere, and it isn't that I'm being a smart aleck. I'm not trying to embarrass them. I'm trying to get them to understand that that's not a technical term in the way that they're hoping it is. It doesn't convey enough real information. So it turns out that the idea of spiritus is that what we all have in common is we're breathers. So being spiritual is supposed to mean, are you treating everyone as if you have in common that your source of life is coming from your breath? Are you respecting all the breathers? Are you holding a universal viewpoint, is what they're actually trying to say. Interestingly enough, in the Sanskrit, we're called Atma, but we're called Jiva Atma when we come to the material world. The word Eve comes from Jiva. Atma and Hiva, or Eva, is the original Atma coming from the transcendental into the material and beginning to breathe. A baby is born when it begins to breathe. Jiva, Atma, air breather. So, this spiritual is actually needing a little more definition. The one I like that's very simple is we're not humans having a spiritual experience. We're souls having a human experience. So with this change of perception comes a change of context. With the change of context comes a change of stress. And with the change of stress, your breath changes. And therefore, yoga begins with how you're sitting and how you're breathing. But before we talk about that, we have to ask, what are you eating? Because you're sitting inside of what you've been eating. So all of these together, we begin to break them down into a vocabulary of the components that could be causing us stress. And now spiritual, at least, has one definition that we can see we have in common. Cut me and I bleed. We all are born. We all grow. We all struggle. We all leave our body at a certain point. Where we go should be interesting to us, and we're air breathers. We're spiritual.
How did the chakras evolve?
I'm sure you've experienced these large clover leaves on freeways at various big cities, metropolitan areas. We've all driven on those and watched ourselves being rerouted from one direction, circled around into another direction, and we note that traffic slows down around those at rush hour. For yogis, the physical body is described as the city of nine gates. So our body is described as a large metropolitan complex with highways and the orifices of our body, our nostrils and our eyes and our ears and our mouth and our genital and our anus, are all places where things come in and out. Through our senses, experiences come in and out. And then inside, things travel in various ways. The chakras are particularly important to describe what happens when the Atma goes down into matter. It turns out that it goes into the basement and goes to sleep. If your body is a skyscraper in the metropolitan, or if there's a skyscraper called your spine to the top of your head, which is the executive suite at the top, at the basement, at the root of your spine, is a thing called the sacrum. And the Atma goes to sleep in that basement, and all of its energy gets tied up there and invested there. And that's when we're in the animal kingdom. When we wake up in the human kingdom, we have more freedom of movement than we have in the animal kingdom. That's why we don't have a habitat, but animals all have a habitat. Jesus said that very nicely. He said, every creature has a place to live, but the Son of Man has nowhere to rest his head. Interesting quote. We don't have a habitat, he's saying. So we should be aware that we're born naked with no habitat. So from that basement view, above us is the whole skyscraper. But at each level you go up the elevator of the skyscraper, there's a different subject. I like to say in the department store that you're on, there's different things being sold at each level. So the chakras are departments of life activities, and there a lot of information and a lot of traffic is happening there. So they end up becoming kind of like hard drives for a computer. They hold a lot of data, but they can also get clogged up. And if you're not careful, your hard drives get clogged up and things don't move through them very well because there's undigested past experience blocking them. The movement of your consciousness from the basement is called the Kundalini. The Kunda is the basement. It means fire pit in Sanskrit. And as it rises up through the chakras, ideally, it clears them out. But if it doesn't, it gets sidetracked and it stays on that floor and then wanders around. And now, instead of being locked in the basement, it's locked on the second floor. So all human beings are more or less blocked in one of these seven areas until their yoga is so perfect that their energy can flow right up the middle channel, which is the fastest freeway, without any obstruction when it goes through the clover leaves, which are called the chakras.
Beautiful. Thank you. Do we have proof that reincarnation really does take place? And if so, how does it work?
That's a great question. I like it because the aboriginals of many different parts of our planet, though they didn't have the kind of very Sanskritic and clinical way of talking about reincarnation that India does, dismissed this question in the following way. They said, we believe that life always returns because we observe that each year everything appears to die and for all practical purposes is dead and then comes back the next year and does it all again and produces fruit again and is alive again and blooms again. So to them, the ability of nature to go to what appears to be death and then to come back to life was the same experience we have when we watch someone leave their body and see their consciousness depart. We treated them as if they were the body while they were in that body, but we know they're not there because we say Bill is gone. So we know Bill was the part that can go. So the last question we have to ask ourselves is, given the complexity and amazing nature of the world we live in, which is most likely that that level of intelligence and complexity and beauty would be built for us to have one experience only and be done, or for us to have many, many, many opportunities to experience it from different angles? If it was a punitive experience, once would be enough. But if it was a learning experience, then continuing to repeat the experience would be analogous to going to an amusement park and only going on one ride and saying, okay, I'm done. Or going on all the rides until you completely have experienced the whole park. Reincarnation is experiencing the whole park, and one life is going on one ride and then going home. Helen Keller summarized this, famous as she was for her senses being so disabled and her being so courageous. And she said, I believe in the immortality of the soul because I have within me immortal longings. She believed her intuition. So one way to answer the question is direct observation. Do you want to die or do you want to continue? The answer is I want to continue. Then what do you think is most likely? That the intelligence that created this amusement park wants you to only go on one ride and go home, or go on all the rides? And at that point, it's up to each individual to decide.
Thank you, Jeffrey. So, following that, fear of death should then be a waste of energy.
This is the beginning point for the yogic process. Because, as you just asked about reincarnation, the question is, if I could use computer terminology, binary. It means there's only two answers, yes or no. One of my fellow speakers and friends when I was a corporate motivational speaker was Mark Victor Hansen, who wrote the Chicken Soup for the Soul series of books with Jack Canfield. And Mark always used to say at the beginning of his talks, so we all want to be happy, yes or yes? So this then becomes the puzzle, that there is no amount of evidence that we can get on either side that conclusively proves what we're going to try to decide. And you can see this by the great respect one has to have for scientists who have huge amounts of empiric evidence but still believe there's only one life, and yet they're brilliant. On the other hand, there are intuitives who don't need any evidence to make their conclusion, and yet they're brilliant. They're brilliant in the way that they live. You see that they're brilliant. They're just brilliant intuitives. The bridge between these two was Albert Einstein, who, when asked, "Do you believe in God?" replied, "Well, if by that you mean the incredible intelligence that pervades all of nature, in which I am constantly in awe, then I would have to say I do." And his theory was discovered by him, not by an empiric process, but by an intuitive guess that arose from within him. And at 16, he began his process. He tried to catch a beam of sunlight with his hand. And he asked the philosophical question, is it possible to do that? Following that thought eventually led him to discover intuitively the principle of relativity, of matter and energy. And his wife then helped him with the mathematics and a couple of friends to turn that into a mathematical formula. So we die or we don't die. Look within. Ask the question, what do you want? Is life saying no? If life is saying no, if that's what you believe, then you're going to believe you have only one life. If you believe that life is saying yes, and with Mark Victor Hansen, I'm in the yes crowd, then you're going to believe yes to life, yes to living, yes to more of this, yes, there's more of this, yes, in fact, you go beyond all of these limitations, which we experience all the time, having a limitation and going beyond it. So yes to finding your potential and going beyond all your limitations, therefore, as we say in love, a muerte, undying. If love teaches us anything, it is that we wish love would never die. So Einstein also said this beautiful statement. He said, if you're sitting in a room with a beautiful woman, then time goes by very quickly. If you're sitting on the burners of a stove with the burners on, time goes by very slowly. And that's called relativity. So if you look at this problem from one point of view, you don't believe it. If you look at it from another point of view, you do believe it. Yogis make their decision with a morte. We are immortal, and therefore they no longer fear death, and all other fears rest upon the fear of annihilation.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Two more questions, because we're running out of time. The second to last question is, you mentioned in the seed event that the universe is a university. Could you explain that a little bit more?
Step one leads us to step two. Because we either believe, essentially, that life is unfair and punitive, which is, there's only one lifetime and everyone starts out from a different point of view, often disadvantaged greatly. So there's no such thing as fair if that's the case. And there's nothing to look forward to if there's only one life. So it could be that life is simply punitive and unfair and essentially meaningless because there's no take home for that. There's no takeaway if there's just one chance. So soon as we think of ourselves as an epic hero on a lengthy journey, traveling way from where we're from in the transcendental to this place called the material world to experience it, then the idea that it's a school of hard knocks or a school of experience begins to make sense. And we certainly then can look with kind eyes at every living entity and say, oh, you're just in a different grade level. You're essentially the same as me. I can see that. My guru in this was Coco the gorilla. Don't know if you know of Coco, but
no,
Coco...
No, I don't know.
Coco was the first non-human who was taught sign language.
Okay.
She had a 400-word vocabulary of the sign language used by the hearing impaired. So what we found out was that primates, who are obviously our cousins, could actually learn a vocabulary like us. My favorite moment was the trainer would go to Coco's cage every day, bring cookies, and say, Coco, want a cookie? And Coco would say, yes, signing. And the trainer would then say, okay, clean up your mess, because Coco had pooped in the cage, and the trainer would say, clean up your poop. For weeks, it went on like this until finally, one day, the trainer said, Coco, hi, Coco. And Coco said, hello, trainer. Coco, want a cookie? Yes. Clean up your cage. Coco said, no, I just want a cookie. Next, the trainer said, no, clean up your mess. Coco said, no, I want a cookie. This is a primate having a disagreement with another primate. But it's a big moment in science. And then Coco says, trainer is a poop. And signs to the trainer that he's a poop. This is the first time a primate other than a human cussed out a human.
Right.
So okay. Coco was apparently higher in the school than we thought.
Right. The last question is, it's a personal question. So what are you representing in this lifetime?
I have decided to represent the invisible possibility that exists in all of us, that we're travelers on a long journey. And I've decided to embody that and invest 100% in that. And my vision of it is that it is that which allows us the grace to have an inner life that is so fulfilling that our competition in this world becomes reduced to the point that we can truly appreciate one another and cooperate together and live on this planet in a gracious way. So what seems to be an otherworldly focus is in fact quite intentionally creating heaven on earth as much as holding an otherworldly focus. I believe that the solution to our dilemmas is to honor the intelligence built into the existence we're surrounded by, trust that it's leading us on an amazing, beautiful adventure, admire one another as fellow travelers, and learn to live cooperatively on this planet. And I believe that is accomplished by embodying our invisible potential which we have not found yet, and believing that everyone can find it, and that when they do, they'll be amazing to us and themselves, and the world will be the sweetest, most beautiful place it could possibly be.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Thanks for having me on your show.